August 20th, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S. And this week I was working on some radio projects in the ham shack, getting my just radios that were out of whack back in working order, and those kinds of things. So really haven't done a lot. Let's go down the list. Next on the list we have Mike AA8K, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinestr.com. Next on the list we have Tom N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave, and good evening to everybody in the group. Hope microphone audio is a little better than last week. This week, I generated the slide deck for DCC, talking about Tangerine SDR and how to implement a personal space weather station from SDR modules once they exist. And the second thing is the interface control document for the clock module was updated, and that's to change the pinouts for all of the clocks to align with the discussion that we had last week. And that's about it.
Well, fine business, Tom. And next on the list, we have N1PJE. Go ahead, Phil.
Hi, this is W1PJE, or Phil. Hopefully everybody can hear me.
User entered your channel.
I've been off doing science kind of stuff. We're actually finishing up a major proposal to keep our Millstone Hill Incoherent Scatter Radar going for 5 years, which is a rather large enterprise, but that's almost out the door. Relevant conversation, Nathaniel, W2NAF, and Gareth Perry, and I, and Ethan Miller, KAGU, have had some discussions of what sort of things to talk about at DCC relative to the space weather station. So I think there's been some formative ideas coming along having to do with David Kasdan's work on WWV, measuring Doppler shifts, and some of my own work measuring timing from looking at WWV tick arrivals. So I'm going to have a little bit more to say about that at the DCC meeting next month. Both Nathaniel and I will be there. And I plan to spend a little more time thinking about how that will hook into wherever Tangerine SDR is right now and where it will be in a couple of weeks. So that's just a summary. We're rotating, as you know, several of the science folks here are rotating in and out. So my job this week is to pick off nuggets here and contribute to the discussion and then report back to my friends at AmSci. I'll leave it there.
Well, fine business. Phil, next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Scotty, we were worried you might be a little late.
Yeah, sorry, guys. I was a little late. It's hard for me to get off work and get here, being on mountain time, and get through the traffic in here. So I missed Tom's comments, but I got most of Phil's. Anyway, it sounds good. We're going to have a good presence at DCC. And I encourage the people who want to speak. Phil, if you and Nathaniel want slots there, write to Steve Bible right away and tell him what you want. He's making the schedule up now. So, and maybe you've done that already. So he'll put you on there. And I don't know if Tom explained what we're planning to do. I think either Friday or Saturday morning, it's going to start off with Tangerine SDR hardware update. And then Tom is going to talk about PSWS specific application of Tangerine SDR, and then we'd like to make it fit in with Phil, your talk, and Nathaniel's talk, whatever you guys are going to talk about, to kind of make it kind of a Tangerine / personal space weather station morning, if you will, and maybe get to three or four talks in a row. Not a lot going on this week. I've been really busy with work, and try to get to it a little bit more this week. Some of my other projects are finishing up, so probably kind of like you, Dave, with your semester finishing up, and now you get to relax and be retired and be busier than you were when you're working. So back over to you.
Yep, fine business. I'm actually starting a new semester I'm retiring in 2 weeks, but I teach the whole semester. So go ahead, and next on the list is Dan in for XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Thank you, Dave. Well, I didn't do much radio this last week. The weather was halfway decent, and it was especially good for flight training every day but Wednesday. So I spent a lot of time flying this last week, probably 32, 33 hours, which is really a lot. So anyway, that's about it for me. Back to you, Dave.
Fine business. So that brings us to the end of the current list, and we're open for general discussion.
Well, Dave, I wanted to tell you real quick, I couldn't resist. I bought a Vim3 board from, I forget what the name is. I got an ad from the Odroid people, and I couldn't resist. So have you seen that new board?
Yeah, I have, and it looks awfully good, but I haven't seen one yet.
Yeah, I was hoping maybe somebody here could explain to me what the neural processing unit was on there. I've never heard of it before, so haven't had a chance to research it yet.
Dave has been talking about these. These are chips that you prepare a AI model, and apparently then it applies that model to incoming data.
So I wonder if that will be of any use to us.
Potentially, if we can figure out how to use it.
This is Phil. One thought about that. My colleagues who are doing a lot of machine learning and AI, there's a distinction, as everybody on this call probably knows, between that stuff that needs to happen in near real time, and then a lot of the analysis that we will do for science, of course, is done in retrospect in batch, where we have the advantage of, as long as the recording is raw, being able to rewind the tape, if you will. And so then there's a separate set of deeper AI stuff that it can occur when time pressure is not the object and you can throw whatever sort of compute you have at it. So perhaps a way to sort that out would be to figure out which tasks in this particular project are the near real-time ones. I know that in spacecraft, like if you're doing a CubeSat and you have very limited resources and you wish to trigger that CubeSat to save something, sometimes you need some real time to get you enough decision information to figure out, okay, that was, you know, I want to freeze the last 20 seconds. So my inclination is here that a lot of those capabilities are tied to, again, defining exactly which use cases you want out of that, which is something that Nathaniel and I have to think about in terms of what are the science use cases. So we're sort of aware of that. But it's interesting to see that there are now commodity chips showing up that have that stuff kind of wired in. That's interesting.
Well, yeah, and I'm not sure. It seems to me that this is like a core built onto the processor as opposed to like a separate chip hanging off the side. Because I've looked at the board and I can't really see anything significant about, you know, a piece of hardware architecture, but it's in there like alongside the cores. So you get like a quad core A73 at 2.2 gigahertz, which, by the way, is faster than the N2. N2 runs the quad core A73 at 1.8 or 1.9 gigahertz. So, and the memory bandwidth is also 1600 megahertz versus 1300 megahertz. So I think it's going to be just nominally faster.
Interesting. Okay. So again, that gets back to, you know, it's the burden is also on the users, being the folks who are going to absorb this and do science, to figure out what kind of default modes do we want to pursue here, and that will tell us how much stuff has to be done in real time. Obviously, you know, whatever you can do in batch, you have perfect hindsight, because, you know, when you can move time backwards and forwards, you make different decisions about whether you, when you can't do that, when this stuff is coming in. Fortunately for science analysis, a lot of this stuff doesn't have the only real-time flavor. So this ties really right into a lot of the AI discussions that are going certainly around our community a lot. So that we have perhaps a role to play here. That's interesting.
Well, so in the simplistic case, this would be like you would collect some data, you'd perform some operations on it, and then based upon the result of those operations, you would determine what you wanted to do with future data. So that's a really simplistic case of AI, but it adapts based upon what it sees in N and does something different in N plus one.
Yes, and in fact, again, to make the analogy to this CubeSat that we're doing for NASA Heliophysics, we have a ring buffer on board this particular satellite, and we can never hope to get any the whole ring buffer down. It would take us probably weeks to download the ring buffer. So the in that case, the platform's job in real time is to do something rather simple, which is to make a spectrogram and compress the heck out of it. And then have that spectrogram available for the human to make a decision that says, aha, I would like that. And then just like a disk, you can start marking off blocks of memory that say, okay, keep that, please. And then anything I didn't mark as being kept, okay, now the recycler is going to go through and reuse that space. So the point is, there's a little bit of real-time decision processing to help you make the decision to pull down some other information later. It's very analogous. It works really well, and it's you run into these discussions anytime you have either, say, a limited pipe going to and from the thing, which could be the case here. Of course, we're going to be deploying this thing on many, many different bandwidths, some of which are going to be pretty cruddy, you know, last mile kind of things. So these same software patterns seem to show up again and again when you think about sort of things. So this will be, again, I think that we can do a very nice job here, but it's nice to hear that some of the heavy lifting for some of that real-time stuff may be kind of being done for us by some of these other markets.
Yeah. So I was thinking if we ultimately get to the point where these stations could be somewhat autonomous in identifying events, so they could have, they could learn what kind of a background is that where nothing interesting is happening. And then if anything deviates from that, in any way, then it could say, ah, well, this is of interest, so I'm going to store this. And that way you might get a much longer ring buffer for events that, you know, basically throwing away baseline data that you really don't want.
Sure. I mean, you know, think about your normal disk. I mean, you know, you have normally your hard disk in your normal computer. The operating system has, you know, its disk table. And it gradually, for example, it gradually marks off, oh, no, those blocks are being used by that particular files, this particular file in the file system. And when you're done with the file, all it does is say, okay, those blocks can be reused again. It's exactly the same management process for the memory in this particular device. Our challenge, of course, will be to come up with metrics that are simple enough that we can utilize some of those, you know. It's the old Rumsfeld thing about the known unknowns. You know, how do you know what you're looking for when you haven't ever seen it before? So it's an interesting challenge to figure out how to be simple, but not too simple.
Yeah, we used to have a customer that would demand of us a list of unknown problems that we were going to face in the debug of the board.
Yeah, I've heard of that one before. We occasionally will turn on the radar here and measure something. And it'll sit there and it'll have really bizarre characteristics, and it's a one-off, it's there and gone. And we have this term called enhanced radar backscatter, which is an equivalent thing to saying, I have no idea what that was, but it sure was bright.
I like an enhanced backscatter. That means interference from another source, right?
Yeah, we just haven't defined what source is. I mean, you know, I will remind people on this list that pulsars were first thought to be the Bell and Hewish, who labeled the first pulsar, labeled them LGM-1, which, by the way, stands for Little Green Men-1, because they said nothing in the universe can be possibly be repeating at this precise clock frequency, must be extraterrestrials. Well, it turns out it was a rotating neutron star, but at the time, it was just, I have no idea what this is, but it keeps occurring.
That's pretty funny.
By the way, it was just one thing to mention here is that I didn't want this group to think that we were not thinking about some of the science to sort of complement what's all this excellent work that's going on in the hardware design. We're very much aware that we need to meet very soon these particular things with some concrete use cases to settle this stuff down. And I know that's something Nathaniel is getting settled again after his move to Scranton, but that is something that a couple of us need to return to very soon. So I'm hoping we can have some focused discussions about that at Tapper. That's at least our goal, and that won't be long from now.
Yeah, kind of like the most of the framework that Tom has worked so hard on getting set up, and me a little bit on getting set up. We can hopefully we'll have slots that we can fill in the blanks or fill in the, maybe not blanks right now, but we'll make them more concrete so that we have a good idea that this is actually going to fulfill some use.
Right. And to reassure everyone, you know, we probably know of two or three things that are known knowns. These are wave structures that we know are out there that we think have already showed up in some of this HF data. And so I mean, it's not like we're starting from a totally blank slate here. We do have some things that we think are simple enough. I think the timing business that's happening with WWV, I think that's going to prove to be one of them. It's a relatively simple measurement that you can make in a statistical sense as well as an individual event sense. But there's unknown physics in there that I still have not completely understood why there are variations. So, you know, we do have a couple of ideas like that that are reasonably simple. We'll just try to flesh them out here kind of in a collective.
Well, it would seem like the first thing that we might want to do, since Dave's WWV receivers are going to be the first out of the gate, is just with our HF receiver, just duplicate his in the data engine and the RF board. And of course, with a little bit more accurate clock, but the idea is just to duplicate that first, and then all the networking is exactly the same.
Yeah, precisely. So our little sort of pokes and forays into doing this using things like Kiwi SDRs, things like, you know, someone's just receiver. These are just our sort of initial research pokings around. The stuff that I presented back at the HAMSCI meeting and at Dayton was really just to convince myself that I wasn't looking at a completely instrumental effect, that what I was looking at was in fact had some geophysical signal in it. So by the time we get to the point where there's something to actually, implement to here, I think we're going to have a couple of reasonably solid ideas about exactly what to measure. So just as a reassurance.
Okay. Yeah. One of the things I want to explore a little bit as we get toward more hardware, try toward the end of the year, is maybe finding a source for a few more funds to build more prototypes, because I think in the current budget we only have like 5 or 6 prototypes, and I think that's not going to be near enough. So I'm hoping maybe Tapper could step forward, and or maybe from some other source you might get a grant to just build more of the same for experimentation purposes.
Yeah, that sounds like a reasonable thing. I mean, there are occasional sort of support things that you can write where they're just going to buy hardware. They're not going to do any supportive people time, but they're going to buy stuff. And that's the sort of thing that you might be able to target.
Yeah, and what I'd like to do is I'd like to identify the people who are going to contribute and just give them a board, because no quicker way to get software than to give an interested party some hardware to put his software onto.
Especially if there are some students who actually have free time and can be guided that are hanging around ready to do that. That's where people like Nathaniel, who are now at a university where he does have access to students, maybe more readily than I do at Haystack, where I'm kind of a bit away from campus. Or Gareth Perry at NJIT. Those are the kind of people that, yes, you want a prototype kind of sitting on the bench there and get some people involved with it. And you'll also find out what's confusing about your system and what doesn't appear to be strange pretty quickly.
Yeah, when they start asking all the dumb questions that really aren't dumb, but show how little you know, right?
Oh, and as everyone in this call knows, you know, that's the difference between prototypes with wires hanging out everywhere that you've made work once and something that's solid enough that you can stand behind it. And, you know, that's what Tapper's all about, is being able to do things that have been shaken out enough that you can stand behind them. And so, yeah, this will hopefully be a natural part of the process.
Yeah, I hope so. We got some pretty high-powered people on the team here.
Completely agree. While we were talking, there was a little note about I was mentioning little green men and the pulsars. The other thing is of course, the famous wow signal that John Krause, the Big Ear Observatory in Ohio, you know, the one very, very coherent burst, which, of course, was never seen again, but which he had marked as, geez, what is this? There are going to be transients like that go bump in the night all over the place. In fact, even the radio astronomy community is dealing with something called fast radio bursts right now, which until recently had not been seen to be repeat. These are very loud things that are coming from unknown objects that you see them once and then they don't occur again. It turns out that some of them do repeat, but these are the sort of things that if you collect enough of them, eventually you realize, oh, you know, really there is some signal there. It's just a pattern that we never saw before. So part of what one has to do with this particular system, thinking from a science point of view, is to leave the discovery space open, to be able to say, okay, there's something where I just make literally the trigger, if you need one, as absolutely simple as possible. The power level was 2 standard deviations above the noise background, and that's my only criterion. I'm going to save a burst of that, maybe a couple of seconds, and then I'm going to tag it. That's how you find new stuff that you didn't know was there.
And the idea is that we're going to be able to have some kind of scripting language or some way to program all these weather stations to search for things like that, to have triggers like that, right?
Yeah, there's kinds of triggers. There's the trigger that occurs internally from within the device, like the device is paying attention to its own data and saying, oh, I saw something interesting in my particular sensor. Then there's the one that's kind of the Bayesian approach, which is the guided one, which says, oh, you know, this other information out of band from me, like NOAA or like the KP index or the planetary AP index or the ring current or any of these other models, says that I ought to be looking for something because I think there's some heightened activity in the system. And there's external triggers and there's internal triggers. And part of the software effort here is going to be to figure out how and where to be able to pull external information in and use that, as well as paying attention to the sensor itself internally. And then the other thing we've struggled with sometimes in these systems is, how does one define the messaging that comes back out of the device that says, hey, I triggered on something interesting. Here's some metadata about it. What do I do?
Well, and if it's an external trigger, isn't the idea that some magical overseeing source, like the cloud storage or the I don't know even what to call it, the mass storage area that all this data is going to go into eventually, there's some controlling entity which will be run by the scientists who are going to say, hey, we need to look for this and such. And they should be able to send out a message to all the stations saying, okay, now look for this particular kind of thing and report back if you see it, or store the data and then report back that you stored it. Is that the kind of operation you have in mind?
Something like that, yeah. That's worked pretty well in the past. Again, it's a balance between things you know about that you want to have occur. That works great for that, of course. For the discovery space, that's just I'll give you one specific example from something that is decidedly not lightweight. I'm on the science team for Van Allen probes, which is a full-up, you know, $1 billion-plus mission from NASA that's been looking at the radiation belts for the last several years. The electric field sensor on Van Allen probes has 2 different modes. It has a triggered mode where they trigger it to say, I want you to measure in this particular spot because we're looking for something interesting. And then they have a burst mode, which is on a timer, which says once every 6 seconds, I want you to capture at high rate this small slice of time. And it just occurs on a timer. Nobody else directs it any more than that. And please store that in your buffer. And then eventually when the buffer fills up, you'll be erasing the oldest stuff. Some of the most interesting science has been done with that second one, which is, hey, I know that there's just literally a timer is going off. And every so often, that timer is grabbing me some nice high-resolution data, and I know it's there. So there's value in both of them. And what the science teams will need to do, of course, like any other thing, is balance resources. And but there is prior art and kind of how to do that. So I know some, you know, between Nathaniel and I and some other people who have done this, we have some experience at it. So I'm hopeful.
You have something to say, Dave?
Oh, no, I was on my other computer. I have 2 computers and they're tied with 1 keyboard. Sorry.
Okay, no problem.
Tom, I had a question. So you mentioned that... So who's going to be doing the presentation at DCC about, can you go over once again, someone's going to be doing sort of the overview of where the project is and then maybe where it's, what it needs right now or where it's going. Can you go over that again?
Yeah. Scotty was planning to do one on Tangerine SDR, you know, what is Tangerine SDR? What are the pieces? what are the variants of the modules? And then I was planning to follow him with, you know, use this particular receiver, that particular clock, and put together the following modules for the personal space weather station. I didn't have any slides right now on the PSWS requirements, like what I did at HAMSI. I could put some of those in if you think that would be useful.
I think what's pretty actually maybe most useful to us is just that we know, you know, just get reminded shortly before this what those are. Okay, if there's some kind of like at HAMSI, if there's a okay, this is sort of the level of performance that we think this thing is going to be doing specifically in the space weather station, then that just means Nathaniel and I can then target our discussions on the science use cases, just to make sure that we're just not wildly out of bounds with, because this thing is evolving, obviously. And, you know, there's been a lot of hard work and a lot of cycling. So just as it, just getting a refresher from you just before this happens so that we can make sure that we've tailored that appropriately would be probably most helpful, I think.
Okay, I've got one slide in there, just what I call key personal space weather station performance needs, which just talks about the two receiver channels, phase noise, receiver amplitude calibration, phase coherence between the two channels, the time stamping accuracy, and the three-axis magnetometer. I don't have anything there about how phase noise requirements were derived, nor anything about how the system bandwidth requirements were derived, like I did the first time. So this just focuses on what the receiver requirements are in terms of the parameters. Do you want me to go into where those come from, or just listing the numbers okay?
Oh, I think for this one, just listing the numbers is okay. And that means that then we can match them and then point to various aspects of them and saying, okay, now the fact that we have two receivers and, you know, there's two receivers and they're coherent to this level means that we've unlocked this particular science application. I don't know that I need to, I don't think I'm looking for just, you know, the okay, we're doing this phase noise because of this. Probably for this discussion, it's sufficient to say, hey, if you really want some details on that, come see us. Or we'll point you to the documentation where that's been developing. But for this audience, we want to, I think, balance the technical specifications that you've come up with the use cases that we see immediately that are not only using those particular numbers, but then are reasonably unique in that without the Tangerine SDR, we would have a much harder time doing those particular applications. So that would be, I think, what Nathaniel and I could bring to it and a good way for us to sort of organize the science use cases.
Okay, very good. Let me shoot you a copy of the slide deck where it is now, and that way you can go through it and see if there's something missing you'd like have added in there.
Perfect, great. I'll make sure to look at that in the next very short while, because we only have a short while. But like I said, I think we do a nice job.
Okay.
Well, so you think that then the way we would do it is we'd have start out with the Tangerine hardware description and status, and then we go into your personal space weather station application of that hardware, and then into Phil and Nathaniel's application of that hardware to kind of define what we're going to measure. Is that the way you see it going? Well, actually, that's directed to both of you, I guess.
Yeah, I think what Phil, paraphrasing Phil, it was kind of now that we've defined a receiver with certain accuracy capabilities, what science does that unlock?
Yeah, precisely. It flows nicely. It says this is not just this is kind of a nice to have in very vague terms. We have a much more specific idea of what's going on, and there's a flow down to what can be done with it, and those of us in the research community are excited about doing that. Kind of puts the cap on it. It shows that this is not something that's just going to go off as an appendix over here, and it's not going to end up being used. We have people that are eager and waiting to use this. It helps. I think it helps sort of maintain the momentum of this is why all of this hard work is being put in.
Oh, okay, so you're thinking we're going to have four presentations then? So it'll be me, Tom, you, and Nathaniel, or do the do you think that you and Nathaniel will have one? Or I'm trying to get the flow down, because I think we could do like I'm thinking of requesting from Steve like the Saturday morning four in a row if we need those, because we need to get a block reserved if we're going to do something like this.
I think when Nathaniel had mentioned to me even the whole concept of going, making sure that both of us were at DCC, which, you know, we went back and forth a little bit and figured out we could do, I think that presenting two different sort of use cases, which would mean two separate things from both Nathaniel first and myself second, would be the appropriate level of complementarity to the two. Because then you've got two talks that say, here's what Tapper is building, two talks that say, here's how it's going to end up, here are some initial ideas about how it's going to be used. So yeah, a block of two by two would be good.
Okay, because I think we can do four in the morning, if I remember right. Is that what you remember, Tom? We have time slots for four before and four after lunch.
Gosh, I'm trying to remember. Let's see. They normally start at, what, about 9 o'clock? And so 9, 9:45, 10:30, and then a break, and then 10:30 to 12. Yeah, that sounds, four before and four after sounds about right.
Yeah, so I'm going to push for Saturday morning, if it's okay with you guys. See if we can get that block reserved, and then if you can work up some titles and abstracts to get to Steve, then we can nail it all down pretty quick.
Sounds good to me, and that will make the four sort of a cohesive whole. If someone is looking over the schedule, thinking, okay, you know, if I attend these four, I'll get a reasonably sort of complete picture of where things are.
Yeah, and I was shooting for Saturday because I think maybe there's some local people who probably won't be there Friday, so get a little bit bigger audience Saturday. You get the early birds on Friday, and you get the diehards on, or I guess the diehards on Friday, and you get the masses on Saturday.
Yeah, sounds good. Both Nathaniel and I, if I'm looking at my thing correctly here, our schedules are both no problem with Saturday morning. I mean, that's ideal.
Okay. And you, Tom, is that okay?
Yeah, I'll be there both days, so either one's fine.
Okay. Well, I'll talk to Steve and see if we can get that reserved, and because he probably doesn't have a lot of the presentations in hand yet because it's early, so it should be okay.
Yeah. You never have the presentations in hand until the deadline has long expired.
Well, yes. If it's from Bruce, then I mean, it's like as he's walking up to the podium, that's when he's making the last changes.
I have colleagues who sit there in the chair now as the previous speaker is concluding. My very good colleague and mentor, John Foster, was very famous for giving a talk in which he attempted to use a figure from the previous speaker that he didn't know he was going to use until he heard that talk. It makes quite an impact when you can do that.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah, so we can do that. We can share our slides and we can segue from one right into the other.
I'll tell you, for clarity, I always like to try to use at least one graphic if we're going to do a sequence like this from the one before, because it repeats something in people's mind, and you know, a lot of information is being thrown at people really fast. You know, it's nice to give them sort of pegs to hang on to when they're trying to figure out how they got from point A to point B. So sure, that sounds like a good idea. By the way, I have a slightly different question again, as you know, I take a couple of notes in this stuff, and then I usually report back to, a few HamSci folks just to make sure that we're continuing to be synchronized. Tom, in particular, you know, we ought to probably, I got a note from Nathaniel, and I haven't had time to look at this, but to take a look at sort of what the latest sort of iteration of things, because there may be things developing in these specifications that are, you know, more that require more input compared to other things. And so if there are things that you think that we should be paying attention to in particular right now, more than other things, if there's anything like that, I can certainly report that back and have us focus on that. Is there anything that you're noticing in the specifications that you're like, boy, this is really the priority number one for comment here?
Probably it would be the receiver requirements document. It's on Tangerine SDR, and I've been trying to keep it updated as our discussions go along. The clock one, I think, is more cut and dried from a specification point of view, and the magnetometer is pretty much a mirror of the sensor manufacturer's data sheet. So the one that really has analog numbers would be the receiver requirements document.
Got it. Okay. We'll try to focus on that. It's the, you know, things, just qualitative things like, you know, where's the noise floor? What's the dynamic range like? And, you know, do any of those severely compromise some sort of default use case that we're thinking about? That's, when I think about it out loud, probably the best thing we can do right now is to get that sort of qualitative feel back quickly. So I will encourage my friends to do that, and along with me, and we'll try to see if we can get feedback to that. Ideally, we could also come to DCC armed with a little bit of that in part of our use cases, again, to motivate some discussion.
Okay, that would be good. Anything we can do to ring that out and make sure everybody's aware of all the numbers, and if we need to change things, there's no time like now.
Got it.
Yeah, this is promising to be a very interesting DCC.
What other topics are sort of on the hot plate here for other things that will seem to be a central focus during this meeting?
Well, the things that I've seen fly by in the past year, let's see, there was a guy in New Zealand, I think, Australia or New Zealand, and they're going to dig me for that because I know they're separate countries and I know they're, you know, but I kind of group the down under guys together, and I can't, my fault, I don't keep them separate. But there's a guy working on a new packet radio that's basically an SDR, and we've been trying to get him to, I doubt that he'll be there, but I don't remember whether he actually published his paper in the proceedings or not. But that's the kind of thing that we'd have. We might have some talk about D-Star DMR system fusion. Digital voice. Let's see what other kind of things that we had. Some high altitude ballooning we had at one time. I mean, kind of the things, I think, because you were at the last DCC, right? So, I mean, you got a flavor of kind of the off the wall things that we can have come up.
Oh, sure. Does the K1JT, you know, / WSJT group ever kind of interface here in terms of what's on their, you know, medium to far future thing? I just say that because not only has, you know, their FT8, which isn't going to be pushing any hardware boundaries, it's certainly a coding application of, you know, an existing voice level channel. Not only has FT8 kind of crushed everything else in terms of number of people using it, but now, if you've been following this, you know, for example, the fact that they rolled out FT4, and if you've been keeping up with this, you realize that one of the default frequencies they picked for FT4 is the W1AW code bulletin frequency. But they have other things that they're working from, and I don't know if Joe Taylor keeps everything really close to the chest, or if there's something that they would be able to say about where they're going that, again, might spark a discussion. Does that team ever sort of do anything at Tapper?
That doesn't ring a bell as far as them coming. I seem to remember Joe came to one of our DCCs. Does you remember that, Tom?
No, I don't. I don't recall that.
Well, that is a good example. Good request, Phil. That'd be a perfect place to give us an update.
Yeah, and I think that if you want to just my experience in trying to, you know, we do a lot of collaboration, and my experience in doing this is, for example, what you might be able to do is just send a short targeted email to both Joe Taylor and also Steve Frank out of Illinois, who has been Joe's partner and has been the one sort of developing the really advanced, I mean, the coding they're using in there is more or less state of the art. They're using low density parity codes and a lot of stuff that's frankly in a lot of advanced textbooks. And so, you know, even just pinging them both with an email saying, hi, this is Tapper, you know, remember who we are. And if you guys have any indication where you think the collective might be going in some way that we could help, if you did that and just dropped an email in there, who knows, you might get somebody coming in and saying something about that. And it would be really great to hear where they're going rather than being on kind of the reactive back end of it.
Yeah, and we're going to have a group of lightning talks, which are, you probably know what those are, with little 5-minute talks and, you know, a 5-minute update on the future of what after JT4 would be a really good lightning talks.
I think so. And they're at an interesting crossroads now because they have so many different modes that developed right now. There's JT65, there's JT9, there's FT8, there's FT4, there's the Meteor Scatter modes, MSK144. All of these have different detection thresholds, different cycle times, and so there's not one right answer. They're targeted for different applications, and it'd be just interesting to see whether their job is to make each one of these just work more efficiently, or whether they have another extra palette of more use cases that they're targeting. One of those might ring a bell with even something that the whole Tangerine effort is doing. So it just would be interesting to hear where they're going.
Yeah, like if they have some overarching plan that they're marching to that they haven't told us about.
Yeah, you know, they some of their reluctance to, you know, sort of lay all of their plans out, I think also just because a lot of that stuff happens in the general community, some of whom are, how shall I say this, less enlightened than the people on this phone call, and who don't necessarily appreciate that there is a deep technical reason for doing this kind of work. So I think that it would be useful with the email just to remind them that this is the perhaps the best example of a community that will inherently appreciate the very, you know, if Tapper is got enough the best technical depth, I think, of any organization to say, oh, wow, yes, I understand why that is really cool, rather than the usual response of why are we doing this? You know, my J38 straight key has been great for me since 1945 kind of thing. So just reminding them that there's a nice audience here that would really maybe get some more ideas going if they just mentioned stuff about what they're doing. That would be kind of good.
Yeah. Did tell you about the informal poll I took on Raspberry Pi ownership at the DCC. Maybe you were there for that.
I'm trying to remember if I was. Just remind me.
Well, I started out, I want to know how many Raspberry Pis people own. And we got up to one guy had 25 of them.
That's the right community.
Yeah. So I told him, well, you have to subtract off the ones that are still in the box. And he said, I still have 25. So they're all in use. So I'd kind of like to see his house.
Yes, and I think that the Tapper community are early adopters and, you know, have similarly interesting houses from that perspective. But, you know, part of what's been exciting for me about watching this whole Tangerine effort come together is that we're fusing together two communities here. We've got the HamSci folks who have, you know, professional research interests like me, and then we have the Tapper folks who are, you know, really, really great at building, you know, low cost yet highly capable hardware. The FT8 and the whole WSJT group is a serious bunch of users who have a particularly set of extremely effective use cases. Adding that into the mix is fusing in yet another community here, and I think the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So it's definitely worth extending a little hand, and it would be better coming from, you know, somebody on the Tapper board, I think.
Yeah, okay. And I'm kind of excited about it too, because it more use cases is better. And it's kind of what was missing from the HPSDR project. It was like we had good hardware, we had good designers, we had good build. I mean, the stuff was built well, it all worked, but it was never really embraced by the community for whatever reason. And I think we're trying to avoid those problems that they had. One, I think, was maybe a little bit too much complexity and trying to make this simple. And, you know, along with Dave making the programmer simple and us not putting a backplane in there with like an FPGA on every board that makes it almost impossible to program changes, doing things like that. And then, it's, you know, seeing other groups that have other use cases come in and get excited about the hardware that we're building kind of gives us a good reason to build the hardware.
Yeah, and the converse is that letting that particular use case community no, hey, there are platforms that we're working on having appearing that have this really good set of timing information. You know, if you dig down into the way that the WSJT suite works, these are asynchronous codes, and they do have to make some assumptions about, I mean, they have to transmit a 7x7, I think it's a Costas array or something like that at the beginning and end of their transmission, because they, you know, they can't assume that the transmission is on frequency, and they can't assume that the clock is exactly right. So part of what they have to solve when they're doing their decoding is local clock offset and also local frequency offset. Well, if you can tell them, hey, you know, we're working on a set of things that, although not as widespread as FT8, you might not have to do those kind of searches. They may be able to do searches on other parameters that they can't afford to do right now because they have to deal with this uncertainty in frequency and time. So I'm sure that the light bulb may go on and somebody may say, oh, yeah, okay, then we can do this other thing.
Well, the thing I wanted to hear was what could I do in the hardware that maybe would help them do something that they want to do? And, you know, this whole project has been collecting requirements from different groups. So at any rate, Dave wanted to say something. Sorry, I cut you off, Dave.
Yes, I wanted to remind both of you that there is a video in the Tangerine SDR video page of Joe Taylor talking at Friedrichshafen last June, and he goes into about an hour and a half of details of his new developments with some technical detail. And so that's one of the talk, but the trouble with the talk is it was recorded by a guy with his camera behind somebody else. He was not like an official recorder, and so there's some waving around a little bit, and the slides on the screen are not easy to read. But I found Joe Taylor on April 1st of this year also gave more or less a preview of the same talk to Fairlawn ARC in New Jersey, which is also a club that Nathan gave a talk to recently, last fall. So there are close connections here both ways. And if you look at those two talks, you can see the slides more clearly in the April talk, and you can hear more detail in his explanation of how the whole thing works in his Friedrichshafen talk. So that would give you some background before you actually ask somebody.
Dave, yeah, that's a good idea. So Scotty, what one could do is basically refer to these two talks and say, yes, we're aware that, you know, there's a lot of detail over here. Here's some information about what this particular project is trying to do. And then, you send them a couple of materials about the Tangerine SDR. Do you think that someone could give us just a very targeted and short summary of which pieces of your technical development path would be interesting when applied to this particular thing that we're developing? That way you're asking for a bit of a condensed and targeted thing from WSJT of where they're going, but you acknowledge, okay, you know, but we know that there's a lot, we've looked at all the rest of this information and we know that there's something there.
Yes, definitely. It sounds like a great idea. I'm gonna go listen to those videos. Thanks for that, Dave.
Yeah, actually, one of them I got a pointer to from Phil Harmon.
Yeah, that's
if you look through the videos we have on the page, Dave's done an awesome job of collecting an amazing number of great videos.
Yeah, so that could really add something quite valuable to this conversation. And if not at this DCC, you know, too soon, but at least just to start the conversation going, I think would be important.
Well, you know, I went to the SARA booth, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers, at Hamvention, and they were over in Building 4. Actually, they were right behind the HamSci booth in the main room there. And I asked them what it is they could use, or what kind of features do they want in their receiver. And so they came up with this. Get this. What they want is they want to be able to receive 100 megahertz simultaneously, and they want to be able to measure the total energy in the 100 megahertz and get a report of the total energy every 1 second. So they want to average the energy over 1 second. So the amount of data is infinitesimally small, but it's condensed down from a huge chunk of bandwidth, and they're looking for what they said they're looking for, pulsars.
I thought that's where they were heading with that. Yep. The pulsar community has become very interested in late in looking at the low frequency signatures of pulsars. Not all neutron stars are the same, and they don't all behave the same as a function of frequency, for sure. And for those of you who have never, you know, pulsars are a fascinating field, because it turns out there's all sorts of different flavors of pulsars. Some slightly speed up, some slightly slow down. Some of them have interesting nonlinear acceleration and deceleration profiles, and you try to use those as diagnostics of exactly what this neutron star is doing. But it turns out that measuring them at a number of different frequencies tells you something not only about the star itself, but it also tells you about the medium between you and the star, if you look at the dispersion of the pulse as it comes through. So the wider bandwidth that you can use for that, the more information you get. So that's very interesting.
Yeah. They wanted like 1 to 1.1 gigahertz or 1 to 1.2 gigahertz. They wanted a huge bandwidth, which of course is not doable with any of the integrated radio subsystem chips that we have today yet. But if that's a requirement, we can build an RF module that will do that. And there's enough bandwidth on the FPGA to easily handle the task to basically integrate the energy over 1 second.
So let's just get these conversations going, and that's how you're going to discover use cases that none of us are even thinking of now.
Yeah, there's another use case that I found out about at Hamvention. I talked to Ed Hare, W1RFI, from the ARRL lab, and he was talking about RF sniffers and measuring like zero crossings of standing waves on power lines. And he said that the power companies can currently do this, but the gear to do it is like, they're $10,000 instruments. And I said, well, you know, we could build a handheld one that would do that and help them identify where all the standing waves zero cross, and that's the origin of the noise source.
Yep. I'm sure those of you in this phone call remember the whole broadband over power lines, somewhat fiasco that occurred quite a while ago. The power companies are not done with that idea. They just are taking a pause and reformatting it. It will be back. So I am sure that characterizing their lines is something that they are still very interested in doing. And so that would fit right in.
Yeah. I've sent him a couple emails and I haven't gotten any response back. So I hope I can get him to talk to me about it, because it sounded like he wanted to help us with some resources that ARRL could provide, like things like a blog on the website or something, or status reports or links or something like that.
The general topic of RFI monitoring, by the way, is becoming increasingly worrisome to, certainly the scientific radio spectrum user community, because of these commercial pressures that are showing up more and more often, a lot of times with a lot of money behind them, who kind of do these bit sort of requests for reallocation of formerly protected blocks of spectrum. And, if you're vigilant, you know, none of these get through, but if they keep asking, occasionally you'll get a slip and then something happens and, you start to have problems. So RFI monitoring itself, or just RF monitoring period, is something that's a growing worry and a need for a use case. So, there could be another niche here for something like that.
Yeah. The 220 to 222 megahertz debacle comes to mind.
Oh, sure.
Say, I would like to put in, Scotty, I don't know if you saw from Dave Witten a while back, but there's a troubling thing related to the PNI Sensor Corporation apparently has been filing for bankruptcy, and the filing dates go between August 8th and August 18th.
The PNI sensor, what is that, the magnetometer sensor?
Yeah, it's the company that makes it. So it might be a smart idea to find an alternative as a backup.
Yeah. Or, I guess, or hope that someone buys their IP and continues to make the parts. That'd be terrible if the one part that does what you need goes away.
So that's interesting. I would suggest that somebody should also ping Hyomin Kim at NJIT, who I know is keeping track of a lot of these magnetometer chips as well, just to see if he's heard also, you know, if anybody's thinking about an alternative. That's kind of disturbing.
Or the guys at Michigan, right, Dave, that came up with it?
I think.
Well, I mean, they identified the chip.
That's right. That's Mark Moldwin's group at the University of Michigan, who's been doing a bunch of magnetometer work. Absolutely. So just making sure that one brings them in, because they may know, we've been hearing that's been happening for them the last 2 months, but we know that, you know, this acquisition is going to happen, and so we think things are going to be available.
I gave you the link to the website. I don't know how Dave Witten found this, but he must have been just searching on the corporation name.
Oh, yeah, because he was looking for the part, I think, at one time before we got the name from the Michigan guys, and so he probably stumbled on that. But it's amazing what you can find on the net, huh?
The internet is amazing. In fact, just the fact that there's a website called inforupsy.com that tracks this stuff, geez, you know, what will come next?
Well, how about the one called whosdeadnow.com, I think is the name of it, and they track movie stars.
Oh, geez.
I mean, it's pretty awful, some of the sites that you could find.
Hey, Scotty, before we go, a couple of quick questions.
Fire away.
Okay, number one, could I ask you to look at the ICD for the clock module? I tried to incorporate all of the discussion from last week and revised the connector pinout. It's in the new document.
Okay, yeah, I saw that. I took a quick look at the names, but I haven't really read through. Was there other modifications that you wanted me to check?
No. It was just the connector table.
Okay, yeah, and we are using the same tables now, right, in our documents?
I tried to copy the format of the table that you had for the data engine receiver over to the clock module and then tweaked it a little bit to work for M.2. But if you look at it, it should look very familiar.
Okay, sounds good.
And secondly, I recorded about 15 minutes of NAQP sideband. And in prep for my seminar, and in going through that, I found that the format that OpenHPSDR uses is indeed 32-bit floating point stereo 192K sample WAV file, and the site I had been looking at didn't have a definition for that, but someone gave me a link to another site that shows that it exists. I have that file, but it's not in WAV format. It's in GNU Radio Standard format. Do you have some place you'd like me to put it? It's about 3/4 of a gig.
Oh, okay. Let me check on my FTP server if I could get that working again. I don't know why it just decided to change file permissions on me, but I need to get in there and fix it, because the SDR stick, SVN, is on the same machine, and it's down too. So something's happened to that machine. I gotta go in there and check it out.
Okay, if you don't have time between now and DCC, I'll just bring a copy of it on a USB stick.
Okay, perfect. And do you happen to know if HDSDR uses the same format?
No, I could not find anything on HPSDR nor HDSDR on the web. I actually had to fire up OpenHPSDR, save a file, and then go in with a hex editor and see what it did.
So you actually ran PowerSDR to save the file then, right?
Yeah, yes, I ran PowerSDR to save the file.
Okay, because
that was for like a 10-second test. The file that's 3/4 of a gig is I saved under GNU Radio, so it's just INQ floating points in Python format.
Okay, so you'd have to convert that to the format the PowerSDR would use.
Well, if you want it to run on PowerSDR, it's going to have to be in WAV format, and I was not able to find a tool to make that translation. GNU Radio does not do it.
Okay. So, you know, maybe the thing to do is if you could put your flow graph on the drive, and we can just try playing around with it at DCC, maybe that'd be the best thing.
Okay, I've been playing with the flow graph for the seminar, so you can tune up and down. All of that works. So I'll put both of those on the stick when I bring them to DCC.
Well, you looking for a guinea pig to try your seminar talk out on? Because I've got a Windows machine that has never had anything, never had power, never had a new radio on it, so we could try out your whole sequence.
Okay, several folks have tried it, but if you want to be a guinea pig and contaminate your Windows machine, you can do that.
Oh boy, that sounds like something I should say no to real fast.
We put it on a Windows 7 machine as well as Windows 10, so I think it's going to be okay.
Okay, good. Well, I'll normally bring, since I'm driving, I'll bring a couple of three computers with me, so I won't let you contaminate my presentation machine. How's that?
Probably a good idea. Okay, I'll pack all that stuff on the stick. That should be all the questions.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, looking forward to seeing that. And I don't know if we can still try to get Nathaniel's recording converted or not, but it's been kind of low on the priority scale here. I can tell you, though, we are running a Morse code class at the Explorer Post. So you got about four students who are at various stages of learning the letters.
Oh, good. Well, this is all single sideband, so no CW. I ran it at 96 K samples.
Okay, but he has recordings of the CW portion of the band too, right?
Yeah. In listening to Nathaniel's stuff, I really wasn't able to pull anything intelligible out of the files.
Okay. Well, there's kind of a twofold thing. I want them to be able to practice tuning SSB. So your file will be good for that because you need a crowded band in order to do that. And then for the code, I don't think field day CW bands are going to be much use to beginner because they go way too fast. But one of the guys here locally has written a field day and novice roundup. Now you probably remember what novice roundup is. It is no more, but he wrote a simulator for it that runs under Windows 10. And so it actually will, it fills the band with CQers. It will answer you if you call CQ. It will, you can work people who are calling CQ. You can set a QRS box so that it doesn't go above about 10 words a minute for a new beginner. So I'm going to try to get their feet wet on that maybe once they get all the letters known.
Okay, maybe between three or four different approaches, you'll have a good complement of stuff for them.
Yeah, great. So thanks for that file. We'll see if I can find a place to store it. If not, we'll do it at DCC.
Okay, very good. I'll try to remember also to bring the installer for GNU Radio on Windows. It's like about half a gig. And so if I have that beforehand, you should have good enough connectivity at DCC to download it.
I've got lots of space on USB sticks, so got a couple of 256 giggers.
Okay, I'll try to remember to bring all of that stuff on a stick. Then I'll make a note.
Okay, sounds good. And you have some time this week? Maybe I'm hoping I'm going to have time this week to work a little bit on the clock module pinout. I think we were going to do that last week, and the week kind of escaped me.
Yeah, sure. Anytime when you're ready, just give me a shout.
Okay, thanks. Sounds good.
Okay, I guess our moderator had to go, right, Scotty?
Yeah, Dave had to step out. So, and we usually try to keep these around an hour. I think we scared him off with the length there. And but anyway, appreciate everybody coming. Unless there's anything else, we can wind it down.
No, well, I'm okay. It was a very interesting discussion. I've made a number of notes. See where we go.
All right, great. Thanks for coming by. It's always good to have new people on, and especially interesting discussions like on pulsars and things.
Yeah, Scott, we'll just for the notes real quick, this Vim module, who is the manufacturer?
That's made by Kadas, Khadas. That's the Kadas.com, or I'm not sure if I pronounce it right. There's a couple of out-of-the-box videos on their website, and they pronounce it the proper way.
Okay, just want to make sure the notes are right, so if anyone comes across the notes later on, they won't have to scratch their head so long.
Yeah, I think you can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it directly from them. You can buy it from Odroid, I believe, too. But I bought it directly from them because I figured it's brand new. I mean, literally, like, came out in the last week or two. Figure I go directly to the source. And it's a little bit cheaper from them than it is from Amazon, I think, because Actually, I take that back. It's the same price, but some of the accessories aren't available through Amazon that you can get from directly from them. So the $99 board cost me $190 by the time I got all the accessories all put in, and the power supply and the memory and everything, the case and the heatsink.
Oh, that's great marketing.
It is, but the heatsink is pretty cool because it's designed to do a fanless implementation. And so we'll see. Maybe I'll if Bill's going to be at DCC, I'll lend it to him and have him run his tests on it, his encoding, decoding tests, to see if he can heat the thing up.
Very good. Phil, anything else?
No, I think that's plenty. I've made some notes here, and I'll follow up.
Okay, very good. We'll see everyone later. Take care.